published a review of 21 brain imaging studies involving approximately 300 meditators. When they looked for areas that consistently correlated with meditation experience, they found that Area 10 had been singled out in research involving a wide range of meditation traditions. This led Fox and his colleagues to conclude that it must be fundamental to the practice. Among people who meditate, studies found not only increased cortical thickness here, but also greater density of grey matter, nerve cell bodies, and enhanced structural integrity of white matter, long connective nerve fibres or axons. Fox and his colleagues speculate that these changes may enhance a person's ability to observe their thoughts and emotions with cool detachment. But the exact function of Area 10 remains something of a mystery. It's the size of a matchbox, around 14 cubic centimetres, and takes up just 1.2% of the brain's total volume. But in relative terms, it is twice as big in humans as in any other great ape, which suggests that it played a crucial role in our recent evolution. This part of the brain is activated during a wide range of tasks, and seems to be essential for doing things that have not been fully automated, and therefore require conscious attention to achieve the best outcome. Contrary to popular wisdom, there is no such thing as multitasking. The human mind has only a single channel of attention and can therefore only focus on one job at a time. Any impression of multitasking given by your awesome office administrator, your spouse, or the president is simply a result of his or her brain's rapidly toggling between different tasks without messing up. How does this work? For now, nothing has been proven, but according to the gateway hypothesis, proposed by neuroscientist Paul Burgess and his colleagues at University College London in the UK, Area 10 facilitates multitasking by acting like the points on a railway track, switching between two alternative kinds of cognition. Thoughts that draw on memories, as happens during social cognition, daydreaming, rumination and creative thought, and those that are focused on sensory stimuli coming from the environment and within the body. These alternative cognitive routes can be conceived as a self-referential narrative mode and a being mode, respectively. As we have seen, the latter also involves the anterior cingulate cortex, insular, and somatosensory cortex, while the former involves the default mode network. When it is working well, the process of switching between the two modes of thought occurs rapidly and efficiently. For example, to allow the retrieval of memories during a conversation while listening to what the other person is saying. In the light of this hypothesis, it makes sense that all kinds of meditation that involve consciously focusing attention, whether on a mantra, a movement, an object, the breath, or a bodily sensation, and gently bringing it back whenever the mind wanders, have measurable effects on Area 10. What may be happening is that this mental exercise enhances the efficiency of the switching mechanism. Picture it as an old-fashioned railway junction with a big lever controlling a set of points that determine whether trains go down one track or another. If the trains represent packages of information and the tracks are the alternative pathways through the brain that they can take, meditation would be analogous to the signalman over time developing stronger biceps and triceps with repeated lever pulls, allowing him to control the points with increasing ease. As a result, switching the stream of thought between the narrative and being modes becomes more and more flexible, fast, and efficient. Burgess and his colleagues speculate that if a person's Area 10 switch point were faulty, this would make it difficult for them to differentiate between thoughts and sensory experiences, which is what happens during auditory and visual hallucinations. To extend the railway metaphor, the points could get switched inappropriately or become stuck in one position, sending trains down the wrong track. Some evidence has in fact been found of atrophy in Area 10 and reduced functional connectivity between it and the default mode network in the brains of people with schizophrenia. Researchers have only just begun to explore potential connections like this between Area 10 and mental health problems. But we can be certain this matchbox-size outpost of the prefrontal cortex does not act alone. The brain operates as a system of interlocking networks, each comprising several regions. As we saw in chapters 6 and 9, for example, overactivity in the default mode network, with its widely distributed components that swing into action whenever we are not focused on performing a task, has been implicated in a range of mental illnesses. Another important player in metacognition is the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, an executive control region that fulfills a vital role in working memory, planning, and decision-making. Interestingly, it has strong functional and anatomical connections with Area 10. In fact, they are neighbours, the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex occupying a region a little higher up on the outer surface of each hemisphere. Like Area 10, it has massively expanded during the course of hominin evolution and, tellingly, has also been implicated in mental illness. Brain imaging research suggests that in people in the throes of depression, and even those in remission who are at high risk of relapse, activity in the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex is sluggish compared with control subjects, whereas the ventromedial prefrontal cortex, part of the default mode network, is overactive. It is as if the brain has somehow got stuck in the narrative self-referential mode of thinking. By contrast, skillful metacognition, which involves switching efficiently and appropriately between the narrative and being modes, seems to protect people who have experienced depression from suffering a relapse. Mindfulness training, in addition to beefing up Area 10, has been shown to boost activity in the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, which may help counter the narrative tales spun by the default mode network. These changes in the brain may be what underlies the success of mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, MBCT, which was explicitly designed to prevent relapse by reducing cognitive reactivity, the tendency for small disturbances in mood to get drawn out by rumination in people who are prone to depression. Once again, it is worth remembering that the symptoms of mental illness are more widespread than is commonly supposed and exist on a continuum of severity throughout the population. It may therefore be overly simplistic to talk about the mentally well as opposed to the mentally ill, as if people could be definitively assigned to one group or another. So when neuroscientists discover that the brains of people who have been diagnosed with these conditions have particular structural and functional characteristics, it would probably be more helpful to think of these as extremes on a spectrum of variation that extends throughout the general population. By the same token, when researchers find evidence that meditation affects regions associated with mental illness, the potential benefits of practice will certainly not be restricted to patients. They will apply to anyone struggling with the everyday foibles of the human mind. Its tendency to wander and get lost in emotions, its selfish drives and endless capacity for taking things personally. We can glean fascinating clues about the changes that were wrought in Siddhartha's brain by dedicated meditation practice in the years after he embarked on his spiritual quest, and their wonderful and marvelous effects on his mind, by scanning the brains of experienced older meditators like those described at the start of this chapter. Area 10 and the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex are among the regions emerging as key players in both mindfulness and mental health. But there is another area that's been shown to be transformed by years of meditative practice. Remarkably, this easily overlooked part of the brain may be involved in the creation of conscious awareness itself. The the insula, tucked inside a fissure dividing the frontal and parietal lobes from the temporal lobe, was already known to be involved in monitoring the internal state of the body, or interoception. But according to Bud Craig, a neuroanatomist at the Barrow Neurological Institute in Phoenix, Arizona, it is also the seat of conscious awareness, or, as he puts it, the feeling of being alive. His theory is that the insula creates a series of snapshots of our internal and external environment, which it progressively integrates with inputs from other parts of the brain responsible for emotion, motivation, decision-making, social cognition, and regulating the physiological state of the body. This mapping process is completed in the anterior or frontmost part of the insula, where information is incorporated from the anterior cingulate cortex, ACC, which detects errors while we're performing a task, monitors conflict between competing tasks, and handles volition or directed effort. In essence, Craig argues that by integrating all these different sources of information, the insula creates the feeling of being alive. In support of his radical theory, Craig cites a wide range of evidence, including connectivity between the insula and relevant parts of the brain, and the observation that the ACC and anterior insula are jointly activated when we experience every conceivable kind of emotion, from maternal and romantic love, empathy, happiness, and sexual arousal, to anger, fear, sadness, disgust, and aversion. The insula has even been implicated in our enjoyment of music, the religious experience of union with God, and the hallucinogenic state induced by ingesting the psychoactive brew ayahuasca. Meditation techniques such as attending to the breath and the body scan aim to sharpen awareness of bodily sensations. So it makes sense that these practices lead to structural changes in the insula. As we saw in Chapter 4, The Second Dart, the insula becomes active when experienced meditators reduce the unpleasantness of pain by tuning into the sensation with an attitude of acceptance and curiosity. The studies reviewed by Fox and his colleagues suggest that even a short meditation course can lead to greater thickness of the cortex and grey matter density in this region. And these changes are accompanied by greater cortical thickness and white matter integrity in its partner in conscious awareness, the ACC. Further evidence is provided by findings from fMRI studies showing that the insula and ACC are more active in meditators than in controls, not only when they are practicing mindfulness but also during a resting state. So it appears that training this circuitry is fundamental to the benefits wrought by meditation. During breath-focused meditation, for example, the anterior insula becomes active when the sensations of breathing in and out are made the subject of conscious awareness, whereas the ACC notices when your attention has wandered and brings it back on the orders of the executive control center, the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. In fact, neuroscientists consider the ACC and insula to be the core nodes of the brain's salience network, responsible for directing conscious attention to important stimuli. Repeated practice may steadily strengthen the network so that present moment awareness can be achieved with greater ease until it becomes second nature. The ability to focus attention on incoming sensory and physiological signals from the body, interoception or body awareness, may be fundamental to our sense of well-being. It acts as a reality check performed by the insula. By contrast, dissociating from these bodily sensations has been linked to a wide range of mental illnesses, including anxiety, depression, addiction, eating disorders, chronic pain, and PTSD. One of the most surprising findings to emerge from neuroscience in recent years is that rather than responding in real time to the vast amount of incoming sensory data, the brain tries to keep one step ahead by constantly predicting what will happen next. It simulates a model of the immediate future based on what has just happened. When its predictions turn out to be wrong, for example, we're feeling just fine, then suddenly experience a stab of anxiety about a romantic date, this mismatch creates an unpleasant sense of dissatisfaction that we can either try to resolve by ruminating and then doing something to alleviate the anxiety, cancelling the date perhaps, or by updating the brain's model of reality, investigating and accepting the new sensation. These alternative strategies employ the narrative and being modes of thought I described earlier in this chapter. Of course, both strategies have their place according to the situation, but an over-reliance on avoidance behavior rather than acceptance stores up problems for the future, because there are many things in life that cannot be changed and therefore need to be faced. Mindfulness through interoception is all about accepting the way things are. When we are mindful, the insula continually updates its representation of our internal world to improve its accuracy by reducing discrepancies between expectation and reality. As we've seen in previous chapters, this reality check, the focusing of dispassionate attention on unpleasant sensations such as pain or anxiety, loosens the hold that they have over us. So the structural changes in the brains of highly experienced meditators of Siddhartha's caliber, in particular in their insula and ACC, may be responsible for the imperturbable calm and acceptance that is the ultimate goal of contemplative practice, sometimes described as enlightenment or nirvana. For years, perhaps because of its hiding place deep inside a fold of each hemisphere, the insula was dismissed as an archaic component of the autonomic nervous system that simply processed data about the body's visceral state. Craig's theory that it holds the keys to conscious awareness has brought it blinking into the light, and it seems the more we learn about the insula, the more remarkable it seems. Evidence is accumulating that it may be responsible for profoundly spiritual or religious experiences. It has recently been implicated in the feelings of blissful, heightened consciousness that precede seizures in some people with focal epilepsy, for example. These ecstatic auras are remarkably similar to the experiences of religious ecstasy described by contemplatives of all faiths down the ages. Writing in the journal Epilepsy and Behavior in 2009, Craig and Fabienne Picard, a neurologist at the University Hospital in Geneva, Switzerland, reported the cases of five patients, including a 37-year-old electronics factory worker who had been experiencing seizures for the past 17 years. Describing the auras that preceded a seizure, he told them, "It is a well-being inside, a sensation of velvet, as if I were sheltered from anything negative. I feel light inside, but far from being empty. I feel really present." He remained perfectly in control of his thoughts and aware of his surroundings throughout. "I feel a stronger consciousness of the body and the mind, but I do not forget what is around me," he said. In the notes the patient made for his doctors about the auras, he was able to write more poetically about the experience, which clearly affected him profoundly. "My inner body arises from an unalterable bliss. I escape into the time-space of my body. It is a moment of fullness in the loophole of time, a return to myself. It is an unconditional, privileged moment of inhaled sensations. My body and my head may interact differently to what every human knows." In a similar vein, a 64-year-old woman described the ecstatic aura that preceded her seizures as an "immense joy that fills me, a feeling of total presence, an absolute integration of myself, a feeling of unbelievable harmony of my whole body and myself with life, with the world, with the all. I feel very, very, very present at that time, entirely wrapped up in the bliss. I am in a radiant sphere without any notion of time or space. My relatives tell me that it lasts 2 or 3 minutes. But for me, these moments are without beginning and without end. Picard and Craig suspected that these ecstatic experiences were caused by overactivation of the anterior insula, because nuclear imaging, using radioactive tracers during the patient's seizures, indicated unusually heightened activity there. Direct evidence of a link was harder to come by, however. That changed in 2013 when a 23-year-old woman with focal epilepsy, whose seizures always began with ecstatic auras, was undergoing exploratory surgery. Her condition, which had seriously disrupted her life since she was 15, was not responding to drugs. The plan was to locate the focus of her seizures using electrodes placed at various locations in her brain and ask her how she felt when the current was switched on. Nervous tissue would then be carefully removed and hopefully the seizures would stop. Craig and Picard report that perhaps unsurprisingly the patient was in a foul mood during the procedure, but the moment an electrode placed in her anterior insula was activated, she perked up and said cheerily, "I feel really well with a very pleasant funny sensation of floating and a sweet shiver in my arms." She said this was exactly how she felt just before a seizure. The feelings experienced by patients during ecstatic seizures have a lot in common with the flashes of blissful insight reported by some people who meditate regularly, both believers and non-believers. The anonymous author of The Cloud of Unknowing described them as the most wonderful sensations of sweetness and pleasure, though he cautioned that their appearance could not and should not be counted upon. If they come, welcome them, but do not rely too much on them for fear of weakness, for it will take a great deal of your strength to sustain such feelings and weepings for any length of time. Perhaps, too, you may be moved to love God for their sake, something you will recognize by the fact that you are excessively discontent when they are missing. If so, your love is not yet either pure or perfect. In other words, the experience was merely a pleasant side effect of the more serious business of getting closer to one's God. Siddhartha, recalling what happened on the night of his enlightenment, described the first 2 of 4 progressively deepening stages of meditation, chanas, as rapture and pleasure. But the pleasant feeling that arose in this way did not invade my mind or remain. In the 3rd chana, he said he experienced a pleasant abiding, but by the 4th jhana he had gone beyond pleasure and pain, experiencing purity of equanimity and mindfulness. Euphoria is not a goal of the Noble Eightfold Path, though it may arise unbidden along the way. Consumed in a suitably conducive environment, drugs such as cannabis and ecstasy can produce similar sensations, and neuroimaging studies indicate that the anterior insula is involved in these experiences too. What ecstatic seizures and the euphoria of meditation or taking recreational drugs seem to have in common is a feeling of intense well-being and connection to everything and everybody as a result of immersion in the present moment and dissolving of any sense of having a separate self. Even for those who don't profess any religious faith, the sensations can be so unexpected and powerful that they create the impression that life makes perfect sense for the first time. In his book Waking Up, atheist writer Sam Harris describes his experience of taking ecstasy at the age of 20. Not at a rave, but while calmly conversing with a friend sitting next to him on a sofa. A certain euphoria was creeping into these reflections, perhaps, but the general feeling remained one of absolute sobriety, and of moral and emotional clarity unlike any I had ever known. It would not be too strong to say that I felt sane for the first time in my life. And yet the change in my consciousness seemed entirely straightforward. I was simply talking to my friend, about what I don't recall, and realized that I had ceased to be concerned about myself. I was no longer anxious, self-critical, guarded by irony, in competition, avoiding embarrassment, ruminating about the past and future, or making any other gesture of thought or attention that separated me from him. I was no longer watching myself through another person's eyes. It would take me many years to put this experience into context. Until that moment, I had viewed organized religion as merely a monument to the ignorance and superstition of our ancestors. But now I knew that Jesus, the Buddha, Lao Tzu, and the other sages and saints of history had not all been epileptics, schizophrenics, or frauds. I still considered the world's religions to be mere intellectual ruins, maintained at enormous economic and social cost. But I now understood that important psychological truths could be found in the rubble. All this from consuming a chemical that excites a structure deep within the brain. What do such experiences and those of epileptics and contemplatives tell us about the mind? We don't know all the details by any means, but the insular ACC, Brodmann Area 10, and the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex appear to switch the mind flexibly between the being and the narrative modes of thought. To return to the railway analogy, the tracks diverge at some point, with one line taking us on what might be described as the scenic route past the wonders of pure conscious sensation. The sights and sounds, feelings, even bliss conjured by the anterior insula. The other line regales us with stories about ourselves, the tales of mental time travel, social intuition and imagination that are the musings of the default mode network. The marvel is that we can learn to control at will the signals that determine which track we take at any particular moment. By honing our powers of attention and emotion regulation through mindfulness practice, we can, if we wish, restrict the time we spend in the self-focused narrative mode of thinking that can lead to anxiety and depression. We can choose to take the scenic route, favoring a more experiential mode of being in which we are not held captive by our thoughts, but rather treat them as transient mental events. Regardless of where or how our minds do this, there is an open space of conscious awareness available to us where the clarity of metacognition becomes possible. As we saw in the previous chapter, when our brains evolved the hardware needed to cope with life in very large social groups, there were some serious downsides. The practice of mindfulness helps us tune out the self-referential narrative mode of thinking and tune into awareness. Describing his own experiences with mindfulness, Jon Kabat-Zinn described it as a joyful return to a more innocent way of being. When you discover meditation, you get this sense of, I remember this. I felt like this when I was a child. I felt completely integrated. I felt completely whole. Then you discover you can live that way as an adult. That's a profoundly liberating and illuminating thing to do. Everything can be held in awareness in that way. So we're not talking about some special magical state. We're talking about awareness, pure awareness. That's what we are cultivating with mindfulness. The alternative narrative mode of thought was recently found to have a lot in common with dreaming. A meta-analysis of previous brain imaging research revealed that a large portion of the default mode network is activated during dreams, whereas executive control areas, such as the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex and ACC, are relatively quiescent. During our dreams, we drift far from reality into bizarre realms where we can meet and converse with deceased relatives or fly down endless flights of stairs. Yet we hardly ever question the experience or become aware that we are dreaming. There is a complete lack of metacognitive awareness. We are not quite so gullible while daydreaming, though we are often unaware that we have lost sight of the task at hand and that our mental simulations may fail to accord with reality. We are dreaming with our eyes open. Of course, dreams can be a rich source of ideas and solutions, grand plans, and fabulous fantasies. Dmitri Mendeleev famously dreamed up his periodic table of elements while asleep. Biologist Otto Loewi was dreaming when he had an idea for a groundbreaking experiment that would reveal the chemical basis of nerve transmission and scoop him a Nobel Prize. But, as in a dream, when our minds wander, we often fail to check our thoughts, feelings, and emotions against reality. We ruminate and worry about things we can't change. We forget to live in the present. As the Vietnamese monk Thich Nhat Hanh writes in the heart of the Buddha's teaching, "If you don't have mindfulness, your whole life will be like a dream." Guided meditation, body scan. Many of us have a strong tendency to live in our heads, losing touch with the body and its ways, treating it almost like a foreign country. We dismiss the body as little more than a troublesome appendage of the mind, when in fact, there is continual two-way regulatory traffic between the two. This interchange only works well if the mind is provided with up-to-date, unbiased feedback from the body. Present-centered, non-judgmental body awareness promotes healthy emotional and physiological regulation by supplying timely, objective information to the brain. Conversely, if the mind tries to call all the shots, this can create a positive feedback loop between emotions and our mental reactions to them, stoking anxiety and suffering, craving and anger. We need to learn how to let go. The body scan is simplicity itself. Take off your shoes and lie flat on your back on the floor. Feel free to use a rug or mat to make yourself comfortable. Stretch out your legs, uncross your ankles, and lay your arms by your sides with the palms of your hands upward. You can close your eyes or leave them open if you think you might fall asleep. Allow your breathing to slow. As your abdomen rises with each inhalation, notice the points of contact between your body and the floor. And as you exhale, feel your body sinking more deeply into the mat or rug, perfectly supported and at rest. Imagine the air flowing in and ebbing away throughout your body as you breathe in and out like waves on a beach. Don't try to change the breath in any way, just allow it to be the way it is. On an out-breath, allow your attention to flow all the way down through your body to your toes and let it rest there for a little while. Investigate what you can feel there as you continue to breathe in and out. Any sensation of warmth or heat, tingling or pulsing. Perhaps the feel of the fabric of socks or stockings on skin. Try focusing on the big toes, their nails, skin. Then see if you can single out each of the other toes in turn and the spaces between them. If you don't discover any particular sensation, that's perfectly okay. You are simply noticing and accepting whatever you find. Don't make any attempt to change it. Repeat the procedure as you shift your attention to the balls of the feet, the soles, the heels where they are in contact with the floor, the tops of the feet, the ankles. Spend as long as you like on each. Now move up through the body following exactly the same procedure of investigating whatever sensation is present. Move from one location to another, spending as little or as much time as you like. Your calves, your knees, the backs of your knees, thighs, pelvis, abdomen. There's no need to mentally elaborate on any sensation of discomfort or tightness, trying to explain or control it. Just explore it, accept it, and then let it go. Move up to your chest, your shoulders, down to your hands, holding in awareness each finger in turn. Move up in stages to your head, your mouth, tongue, nose, jaw, ears, and scalp. Finally, take in the body as a whole and its points of contact with the floor, its location within the room. Take a moment to enjoy this sense of calm and interconnectedness with everything. The body scan is a very relaxing meditation, so if you do fall asleep, there's no need to feel guilty. Perhaps next time you can try with your eyes open or sitting upright in a chair or on a cushion on the floor. As in any meditation, you take the body scan with you throughout the day. At moments of stress or anxiety, or if there's nothing in particular going on to hold your attention, it can be soothing to bring your attention into the body, particularly the hands and feet, allowing it to rest there for a while. Chapter 11. Mind Mirrors. Make your mind a fortress and conquer Mara with the weapon of wisdom. Guard your conquest always. The Dhammapada, translated by Eknath Iswaran, verse 40. I was hanging out with this bunch of dopeheads on the beach, the middle-aged man tells his audience. After graduating, his 21-year-old self could have walked straight into a magnificently paid job for life. His godfather was a partner at De Beers. But diamonds were not exactly Jerry's thing. Instead, here he was 7,000 miles from home on Parangtritis Beach in Java with a group of other white middle-class Westerners who had dropped out. I had left England on a one-way journey to the east to try and discover some kind of spiritual direction, he says. Things were not turning out quite as he had hoped. My head was spinning with all these chemically assisted confusions and the idea that here I am on my spiritual quest, trying to pursue this mystical lifestyle, and yet there was this mess of thoughts and a kind of jangled, ragged anxiety. It was getting towards sunset one evening when he set out by himself along the sand to visit a shaman named Dalang, whom Jerry and the other beach bums had befriended. The shaman lived in a cave about 15 feet above the beach that the sea had hollowed out of a rocky outcrop thousands of years ago. Perhaps Dalang would have some words of wisdom to soothe his frazzled mind. Approaching the cave, he saw a man sitting near the entrance in the full lotus posture. But it wasn't Dalang. The sun was setting, so there was this golden light. He looked basically like a surfer dude. Blonde hair, beard, bare-chested, sitting there in a pair of shorts, absolutely poised. But as I got closer, the contrast between this perfectly still serene figure and the rattling mess in my mind, it got stronger and stronger. As Jerry climbed up to the cave, he says, there was this extraordinary feeling of, that's what you need to do. That's where you need to be. At that time, he'd never seen a Buddha image. He had no connection with Buddhism whatsoever and hadn't met anyone who meditated. I didn't want to disturb this serene, holy being, so I just sat down, leaning against the rock wall of the cliff. But after a while he opened his eyes and they were exactly the same colour as his shorts, this bright turquoise blue. And he looked at me, smiled, didn't say anything, and I was like, so full of 1,000 things I wanted to say. I wanted to ask, so small and wretched and frazzled I couldn't say anything. So I just looked at him, and looked at the sunset. and after a while, I can't remember whether he got up and walked away or I did. The moment passed. I never found out who he was or where he came from. Maybe he was a Deva. I don't make any claims, but that particular day, that particular presence touched something in me that said, "Yes, that's where you need to be. You don't have to dwell in this confused, jangled mess of feelings." I didn't quite get to the point of thinking that if I stopped consuming my, he struggles to find an appropriate euphemism, herbal mood adjusters, that might have an effect. I was still convinced that the more stoned you were, the closer you were to reality. I hadn't quite got past that particular view, but eventually I did. The powerful image of the serene meditating figure stayed with him, and within months led him to Wat Pa Nanachat, the International Forest Monastery in northeast Thailand, where 2 years later, in 1979, meditation master Ajahn Chah ordained him as a forest monk, and the beach bum Jerry Horner became Bhikkhu Amaro. Scientists have unpicked the firing mechanism of isolated nerve cells, cracked their signaling code, and are using increasingly sophisticated technology to interrogate the workings of the brain. But the operation of the 3-pound organ we all carry around inside our skulls remains largely a mystery. If you didn't already know its wonderful and marvelous qualities, such as consciousness, metacognition, language, love, and creativity, you couldn't begin to predict its abilities from an examination of its individual components. The brain is so much more than the sum of its parts, not least because each of its 100 billion nerve cells is an information processing unit in its own right, interconnected with thousands of others. And each densely populated region is just a single node in many interconnected networks. No wonder neuroscientists are still puzzling over what their MRI images and EEG traces actually mean. The scale of the challenge facing them is breathtaking. It's as if upon hearing an orchestra perform a violin concerto, you were to attempt an explanation of the music by dismantling each instrument in turn. You would end up with a tangle of catgut, scraps of varnished wood and metal tubing, still none the wiser. Like Jerry Horner, Britta Herzl was fortunate to discover meditation at a young age, beginning her practice at a yoga ashram in India during a gap year before university. Unlike Horner, however, she didn't pursue a monastic career but has spent the past decade using science to investigate the effects of meditation on the brain. She now works at the Technische Universität München, Munich Technical University in Germany. In the meditation research community, myself included, we really do believe that it does good to your body, your physical health, and we believe that it must have beneficial effects on your brain as well, she says. Nonetheless, she realizes that, like any scientist, she brings preconceptions to her work. She knows all too well that her own brain has been hardwired by evolution to see patterns where there may be none. This is a particular problem when interpreting data from brain scans. We are trying to find something or coming with our own ideas. That's true for all neuroimaging research, but we are still at the very, very beginning of understanding. There is so much more work to be done. I'm thinking that when we look back in 20 years, we'll just laugh about some of the ideas we had. By focusing on the music of the mind rather than the instruments playing it, Buddhists have won a head start over neuroscientists of a few millennia. Their approach has always been reassuringly analytical, almost scientific. Monks and nuns, if you will, are like cognitive psychologists sitting in the seclusion of their cells, probing the relationship between their thoughts, feelings, behavior, and well-being. We are not statistical scientists, says Ajahn Amaro, who before embarking on his spiritual quest in Asia dipped a toe in mainstream science earning a degree in psychology and physiology from the University of London in the 1970s. We don't run labs as such, but our way of practicing and teaching meditation is very experientially based. It's what actually helps people. We are working with the mind to understand it better and train it to be more malleable and function in a more balanced way. Novice monks, like students of science, are encouraged to be skeptical of received wisdom and think for themselves. It's a fundamental principle, says Amaro. In the Kalama Sutta, the Buddha says, don't believe what I say, don't believe what is logical or handed down to you by tradition, but whatever is beneficial to you and to others, that is praised by the wise, take it and use it. And what is harmful to you, obstructive and makes difficulty, well, then leave it aside. So you are the arbiter of what is true and good by your own experience, and you learn your own lessons. He values the insights about meditation provided by modern psychology and neuroscience, not necessarily for their own sake, but for the pragmatic reason that most non-Buddhists are more likely to be swayed by the objective research of scientists than by the subjective reports of monastics. At MIT in 2003, at the historic first public dialogue between researchers and Buddhist contemplatives, among them the Dalai Lama, he coined the memorable expression, "the great God of data," to describe the hold that science now has over much of humanity. The belief that something isn't worth doing until its high priests have sanctified the practice in an MRI scanner or a randomized controlled trial. Despite his reservations, he is happy to attend scientific conferences and contribute to dialogues if it will promote research into mindfulness, compassion, and loving-kindness, and a wider dissemination of the Dhamma, the universal truths about human existence he believes the Buddha discovered. Mindfulness research conferences, particularly those attended by Jetsun Jumpel Ngawang Lobsang Yeshe Tenzin Gyatso, a.k.a. the 14th Dalai Lama, draw worldwide press attention and a celebrity following. Hollywood actors Goldie Hawn and Richard Gere were in the 1,200-strong audience at that first meeting of minds in Cambridge, Massachusetts, more than a decade ago. But this wasn't the first time the Tibetan spiritual leader and scientists had put their heads together. They had been having informal, private discussions for years, culminating in the establishment of the Massachusetts-based Mind and Life Institute in 1987 by neuroscientist Francisco Varela and the businessman Adam Engel, which put the conversation on a more formal footing and set the stage for public dialogues over the ensuing three decades. Along with around 1,700 scientists and clinicians from 134 countries, I attended the Institute's recent symposium for contemplative studies in October 2014 at the Marriott Hotel in Boston. On the second day of the four-day meeting, the Dalai Lama was scheduled to share a platform with neuroscientist Richard Davidson and psychologist Amishi Jha. Overnight, an entire floor of the hotel had been locked down and a security barrier erected across the wide corridor leading to a ballroom the size of a football pitch, where the event was due to take place in the morning. At 7 a.m., unsmiling security guards in dark suits and black ties began ushering delegates through airport-style metal detectors, moving in to conduct more intimate head-to-foot scans with handheld devices whenever someone's house keys or loose change set off the alarms. An information card delivered to every delegate's room at the Marriott recommended that we arrive at least an hour before the event was scheduled to start and instructed us to carry a government-issued photo ID and refrain from bringing any of a long list of items, including rucksacks, umbrellas, liquids, and weapons or tools of any kind. At the close of a meeting the evening before, The chief organizer of the symposium reminded the assembled scientists, clinicians, monks and nuns that they would have to leave their guns behind in their rooms if they wanted to attend the dialogue. It was a joke, of course, but the threat of an assassination attempt was real enough. Inside the security cordon, the atmosphere was an odd mixture of calm and excited anticipation as delegates lingered around the entrances to the ballroom, absorbed in animated discussions with colleagues and new friends. They knew they had a long wait ahead of them. Several others found quiet corners to practice their yoga or sit cross-legged meditating on the carpet in the corridor. Needless to say, thoughts of violence were far from our minds by the time the Dalai Lama took to the stage shortly after 9 a.m. and was introduced by the president of the Mind and Life Institute, Arthur Zionk, to rapturous applause. One of the stated aims of the dialogue was to discuss what guiding principles should govern the application of mindfulness in settings such as business and the military. For several years, Mind and Life fellow Amishi Jha, sharing the platform with Davidson and the Dalai Lama, had been investigating the effectiveness of a mindfulness training program designed to boost the resilience of U.S. Marines, with grants from the U.S. Department of Defense. But tact and diplomacy prevented any strong opinions from emerging. This was a dialogue, not a debate. Asked later in the discussion about how his interest in science originally developed, however, Gyatso said he'd been fascinated by technology since his childhood in the vast Potala Palace in Lhasa. Modern technology had yet to reach Tibet at this time, but he recalled being given a clockwork toy British soldier with a gun that he played with happily for a few days before taking it apart to see how it worked. As a 19-year-old touring China on a state visit, this was after the Chinese annexation of his country but before diplomatic relations had broken down completely, he was captivated by the giant hydroelectric dams and metal smelting works his hosts were so keen to show him. Over the past 50 years, Gyatso has embraced science more closely than any other religious leader and sought to incorporate its insights into the worldview of Tibetan Buddhism. In the Gelug tradition, with which he is most closely associated, he has made science and mathematics compulsory in primary school education. Science has also become part of the Tibetan monastic university curriculum. His Holiness is on record saying that he would abandon any tenet of Buddhist teaching if it was revealed to be incompatible with scientific evidence. In his book, The Universe in a Single Atom, he wrote, "Buddhism must accept the facts, whether found by science or found by contemplative insights. If, when we investigate something, we find there is reason and proof for it, we must acknowledge that as reality, even if it is in contradiction with a literal scriptural explanation that has held sway for many centuries, or with a deeply held opinion or view." The passage from the Kalama Sutta that Ajahn Amaro quoted to me says as much. At the Boston Mindfulness Symposium, Gyatso revealed he had long since abandoned traditional Tibetan Buddhist cosmology after learning about the extraordinary discoveries of modern astronomy. It must be noted here, however, that there are some tenets of Buddhism, such as the belief that all living beings are subject to a cycle of birth, death, and rebirth, that cannot be disproved by science. I'll say more about rebirth in the final chapter, but suffice it to say here that this is one place where scientists and religious believers must politely part company. Just as no scientist will ever prove conclusively that, say, the flying spaghetti monster does not exist, nobody can disprove the existence of heaven, hell, gods, angels, past lives or future lives. They can only infer that they are not very likely. Despite these no-go areas, there remain numerous avenues for collaboration, though one sometimes gets the impression that monastics, including the many Tibetan monks who have volunteered for research projects, are only allowing their brains to be picked and scanned in a spirit of slightly bemused compassion. With his characteristic big-hearted guffaw, the Dalai Lama teased scientists gathered in the Marriott's ballroom. "I'm a Buddhist monk. I don't need science." Explaining why he was so glad scientists had begun to investigate the benefits of meditation, however, he conceded, "When I talk about Buddhist literature, people may not listen." Echoing Amaro's sentiments, he said the public was more likely to pay attention to scientists because they were the